Hello, and welcome to another special edition of Stephanomics from the Bloomberg New Economy Forum in Singapore. Today we're going to play you a wide-ranging debate I had on a pretty fundamental question. How do we feed the world and also save the planet? The speakers were all able to provide a different piece of the answer. You'll get a better sense of that from my introduction to the session, which we're going to play in a second. But just so you know who you're listening to, I should say the first speaker was Aloysius Atta, co-founder and CEO of Farmerline, a company that works with hundreds of thousands of farmers across Africa. And then next, it was David McLennan, chairman and CEO of Cargill, one of the world's biggest agricultural conglomerates. Then Walter Bowman, chairman and CEO of the German pharmaceutical giant Bayer. And finally, Sarah Menke, CEO and founder of the data intelligence company Grow Intelligence. How do we feed the world? The tools we have as a planet for answering that question, like so much else we've been discussing over the last few days, have changed radically in the last 10 or 20 years. The technology, the underlying technology, the data, the intricate global supply networks have all changed. But we know that the climate, the environment has also been changing before our eyes, and it's changing almost by the day, making the challenge harder in many ways. We've already got crop yields severely affected by climate change in some of the most vulnerable economies. And the United Nations predicts average crop yields could fall by 30% if we don't change, even as the demand for food by 2050 increases by 50%. So that's the long-term challenge. But as I've increasingly realized talking to our panelists, there is a short-term crisis in the agricultural supply chain that has just unfolded in the last few months, is now raising real questions, particularly for farmers on the ground, not just the 30% rise in food prices that we know about, but fertilizer prices going to an all-time high. How do we feed the world in this changing environment? We've got all pieces of that agricultural supply chain represented here. The science behind the resources that farmers use, someone who works closely with farmers, the businesses that get the food, the crops from farms around the world, and now the data we have to try and solve that question more intelligently. Aloysius, I mentioned at the start this crisis related to fertilizer prices that I think some people, at least in this room, would not be fully aware of. Just paint us a picture of that. What's the situation right now? What's the challenge that farmers are facing today?
Thanks for the question. So I'll focus my opinion on small-scale farmers in places like Africa. The reason is that they are often not in the middle of most conversations, and they struggle to access high-quality fertilizer and seeds. Just to give context, fertilizers like NPK were invented like over 100 years ago. African farmers currently only are able to apply about 14 kilograms per hectare, while their counterparts in the rest of the world apply over 120 kilograms. So they struggle. But at the same time, they are tasked with this enormous responsibility of feeding one third of the world today. If you look at the situation happening in Madagascar right now, where for the first time in our modern history, where there is famine and there is fear of food insecurity for close to a million people, and this is not caused by war, but it's caused entirely by climate change, the time is now to come up with innovation and services that actually ensures that small-scale farmers in places like Africa actually get high-quality fertilizer and seeds on time and the support that they need to grow more food to feed the future.
And David McLennan, just thinking about, as I say, the short-term situation, how bad is it?
I think the food and ag system has proven to be very resilient, perhaps surprisingly resilient. I think it underscores the importance and the benefits of an interconnected food supply system. So we've been able to get food from where it's produced to where it's needed, with some exceptions. There have been spot shortages, there's been disruptions, but you talk, Stephanie, about the impact of climate change, and you think about reduced yields. There's also the components of climate volatility, for example, increased hurricanes. So one disruptive event that we were impacted by was the hurricane that hit the Gulf of Mexico and Louisiana early in the fall, which we lost two of our facilities where we load the grain that comes down the Mississippi River, put it onto barges or to ships to get it out. And we were shut down for several weeks. We have one facility that is still getting up and running. So notwithstanding the inevitable natural disasters coming from climate volatility, by and large, the food supply chain has worked pretty well in the last year or so with COVID, but nonetheless, it's something we cannot take for granted.
Bernard Bowman, I've talked about people at different stages of the supply chain. You're fundamental to the science, the products that farmers are putting into the ground. How has that piece of the challenge changed in recent years?
There are three things that are really important. Number one is agriculture has become more sustainable. Yeah, now more than ever, if you look at the massive impacts that climate change is going to have on all of us, and that means that that agriculture has to contribute its part to removal of greenhouse gases. So we have to find these solutions. The second one is we have to reduce the footprint that is being used by agriculture, while at the same time increasing yields, because as you mentioned, we need to produce much more food in the next 20, 30 years in order to feed a growing population. Yeah? So 50% increase, while at the same time, as a minimum, not increasing acreage, but ideally bringing more intensification on existing acreage, while at the same time freeing up acreage for reforestation and carbon sequestration. And the last thing is that we have to find much more resilience in agriculture systems, which means better varieties that can stand drought, other properties that will make plants more resilient, and with that create better and more predictable harvests altogether. So the two examples I would give, since you also touched on fertilizer, is that fertilizer has been a real blessing to modern society, because without the invention of nitrogen fertilizer about 100 years ago, we wouldn't be able to feed the people that we have on the planet today. Having said that, after 100 years, there may be the next big revolution coming that is informed by biology on one side, by technology, and on the other side by artificial intelligence. That's what people call the biorevolution. And what we are working on specifically is to find ways to teach plants to fixate nitrogen out of the air rather than having it produced and then put on the acre, which is a huge contributor to global warming, because that alone accounts for about 4% of greenhouse gas production annually. The second piece that is equally important is when it comes to resilience of plants. In the 60s, there was one of the big then called green revolutions that was driven by the inventions of Sir Norman Borlaug, with a shorter growing and more resilient wheat that tripled the yield in India. Today we are working on something similar in corn. We are short stature corn, which is less susceptible to lodging, and which can be planted much more denser. Yeah, and can also yield other agriculture practice, is the next big thing to come. And we've started that with some pre-production launches in Mexico, and we are scaling up over the next years to come. Yeah, so those are the answers that we are working on with our people.
Sarah Menke, when we think about sort of squaring the circle, where does data and where does grow intelligence come in?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I think the answer is capital, right? All of this is going to cost money. And that money comes with risk. and you have to price the risk associated with the capital that gets deployed. And you know, the example I gave you was, I was in my past life an energy trader, and when I first started trading oil and gas, if a producer came and wanted to hedge oil 2 years forward, it was very difficult for us to go out into the market and sell that 2 years forward. By the time I left to start Grow, we could sell it 10, 20 years forward that funded all sorts of innovations in the energy market that made things like shale oil, shale gas possible. Gas prices went down, coal got priced out of the market, renewables became a possibility. So, but there was really long-term changes that happened because capital flowed well. Capital flows well when there is good information. And so data becomes necessary infrastructure for driving transformation and change, because this change is going to require lots and lots of capital and lots of long-term capital. And agriculture capital today is too short-term. I mean, I think that, and data is infrastructure. We just view it as a highway.
Now, probably Bloomberg is the one company that you don't have to give a lecture to about the importance of data and the power of data and transparency in pricing, in fueling a whole global company, let alone anything else. That the capital piece, I know, Aloysius, that's one of the things that you're focused on trying to bring to farmers. So just explain that a bit.
Well, so the only source of funding for most farmers in places like Ghana is mostly banks. Banks require farmers to bring some form of collateral in order to access capital. That alone is a limiting factor on how much money farmers can get. And farmers need money for a few things. They need money to access their fertilizer and seeds. And without affordable capital, without enough blended capital around, farmers are often constrained on the amount of fertilizer they can get to till their lands, grow more food, and make more money. So there's a massive opportunity, to fill that gap. And that's what Farmerline does. We've digitized over 1 million farmers, and we finance farmers, and we use alternative data sources to give us information about the farmer, and that allows us to take risk. And in giving them money to purchase fertilizer and seeds, that allows us to purchase their food crops at the end of the season so that they can make more money. But we're just one company. We can't do it all. So there's a need for governments. There's a need for DFIs, corporations to come together and find new ways to make capital affordable for farmers so they can be able to get all the tools that they need in order to grow more food, to feed the future.
But how much is... So when Bernard Berman talks about the technological solutions of how do you use... You want to use less acreage, you want to reforest, you want to have the... Yeah. How much does that figure in the day-to-day calculations of the farmers that you work with?
Your
trade-off.
Yeah, it all comes down to training, and giving out information to farmers, right? So the biggest challenge today is that the information that actually exists is in English, it's online. It's not in formats that farmers can easily understand. And if you pass information down to a farmer and you don't train them properly, if there's no proper training, there can't be any change in behavior. If there's no change in behavior, there will not be any adoption. So the transition from old practices to climate smart practices actually slows down. So there is massive room to figure out a way to use digital tools to offer information to farmers in the language and the format that they can easily understand. Ghana alone has 58 local languages, 58. Nigeria has 200. So if you want to be able to communicate, how to use seeds well, how to, plant to reduce the impact of climate on the soil and farm, you need to be able to meet the farmer where they are. And local language is one of the ways to go. Giving them information in the language that they understand, leveraging the trust network that exists around farmers, the agents in their community, the extension officers, those are still very relevant.
David, I mean, I think that the problem is often that the resources will go to the developed markets, you go where the money is. And actually, when it comes to some, certainly we know the environmental challenges is a greatest in the places where perhaps the market opportunity has been smallest in the past or less obvious. So are we doing enough to help farmers do this kind of innovation?
Are we spending enough time and capital where it's needed the most? The answer is no. And particularly in Africa, I mean, Aloysius did a very descriptive spokesperson of what can be done in Africa, for example. So years ago, I was in Zambia, where we had a farmer training program at the time, and they apply their fertilizer with a bottle cap from a soda bottle. And so you can triple and quadruple yields by, here's modern fertilizer technique. Here's when you should bring your crops to market. Here's how you can store them effectively. Here's modern watering techniques, building up berms so to prevent erosion. But the scalability at a small scale, working with farmers, and so I've listened to each one of the panelists, it all comes back to the farmer, yeah. Whether it's data or seed technology. To Sarah's point about getting better data to help, to Aloysius talking about training, that's where it begins. It's not just yields, but it's also in terms of sustainability, which is a topic I would imagine we'll talk about in a few minutes.
I feel like we're talking about it now.
But, yeah.
but Werner, you mentioned green revolution, and you know, obviously there's been at stages in the last 30 or 40 years where that kind of innovation has been controversial. There have been questions about the impact of it. You know, GMOs were the sort of latest round of that. I would say the debate's been reopened by the urgency of some of the challenges that we're facing on the climate front.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one, Stephanie. The first question is, has that controversy been going on for the right reasons or not? And if you dial back to when the controversy around GMO began, it was actually a discussion that originated at Greenpeace when it came to the next big campaign, yeah, that you could spook most people with. Yeah, and which better area to do that than with food? That's where it started. Yeah, where they said, hey, we have to go after that or against that technology.
Whoever thought of Frankenfoods.
That's a fantastic fundraising opportunity. And what they did with it, yeah, and you know, depending on who you talk to today, they will also acknowledge it, is that they prevented an awful lot of people, yeah, from having the benefits of that technology. In particular, if you look at, for example, vitamin A enriched rice, yeah, golden rice that has been deregulated and approved in a number of countries by now, that would have prevented many, many, many kids from, you know, getting blind, yeah, because of that vitamin deficiency. So having said that, I think there's an increasing acknowledgement of how important that technology is for a number of reasons, also when it comes to sustainable farming practices. And what we see today, both with traditional GMO and then on the horizon, new modern breeding technologies, which means applying new technologies such as CRISPR-Cas gene editing for precision breeding that is quote-unquote nature identical and not transgenic, this is something that we see with, let's say, renewed openness, yeah, also when it comes to deregulation. And you know, before we entered the stage, I was talking to Aloysius that we see that now happening in Africa, which is interesting that Africa takes the lead, yeah, with some of these approvals now in Ghana and Nigeria, where actually Europe is falling behind. We have it in North America, we have it in Latin America, and Europe, which has been a little bit agnostic to some of these modern technologies for the wrong reasons, is falling behind. But there's hope that we'll catch up also with new legislation that might be coming over the next years.
David, on the GMO piece, I know it's not everyone's popular favorite subject, but when you talk about the long-term picture, does it have to be part of the story for all of the discomfort somehow?
It absolutely does. So I'm in about to start my ninth year in this job. So when I first started in this role, 2013, 2014, GMOs were the hot topic, whether it be protesters and literature, and we could not figure out why, because ultimately GMOs, I mean, they got branded Frankenfood, but ultimately they have been behind since early part of the 20th century. Increased yields, increased access to food, increased farmer livelihoods around the world, and they're a tool for sustainability. But the dialogue, the storyline got into the system, which is they're bad for you, you shouldn't consume them. But things like what Werner talked about, crossbreeding, or there's mangoes have been GMO engineered since the 1960s, but I think people became fearful of them. To the follow-up, Stephanie, about soil health, you're absolutely right. And this next iteration, or I'll say the current iteration of sustainability in farming, has to include regenerative agriculture, whether it be no-till, whether it be crop rotation, but to improve soil health and use soil for carbon sequestration is becoming more so and will become more so part of the solution to improve farmer livelihoods and to improve the greenhouse gas footprint of farming.
Sustainability has been part of agriculture since agriculture ever started, right? Like since the Neolithic Revolution, essentially. And so I think sustainability is a core part of the agricultural ecosystem. And so it's not that data is an answer, but that it is actually agriculture and people who understand agricultural markets, I would argue, probably understand our earth, the environment, and climate in ways that the average person in this world don't understand because it's their reality every single day. There was a famous quote I had seen once that said, eating is an agricultural act. And it was a t-shirt actually at a coffee shop, and I bought it. Then I went and I got my team to make a new version of that t-shirt, which was living is an agricultural act. Because if you ask people the question, what's your first interaction with agriculture? When you wake up in the morning, most people say, my cup of coffee. They forget about the sheet of cotton they slept in. They forget about the fact that the soaps they used have oils. They forget about the mint in their toothpaste. It is so a core part of our life and every part of the way we live, and we don't understand it. And I really believe that sort of the contribution that the agricultural industry as a whole can have to dialogues around sustainability and to driving change in sort of the world is large, and I think we're only just beginning.
Feeding the world is partly, the more you get into this debate, is partly about not throwing food away. If we're throwing away a third of our food, I mean, David, isn't that a... How does a business like you address that issue?
Yeah, it's... I mean, food waste, it exists at all parts of the chain. And so if anybody who is American or has dined in American food service knows, the portions are obscene and rarely get fully consumed, or they shouldn't be consumed for health purposes. But I think it's what we're focusing on is waste on the front end of the supply chain. So I think when you focus on improving farmer education, modernizing farming techniques, the use of GMOs to better utilize the resources that go into production of food, to production of everything, to Sarah's good point, that's where I think waste can be eliminated. And it's not as visible. People don't see the front end of the supply chain. They see how much waste they, you know, as I said, in food service in restaurants, or it might be in food that's gone bad. But I think there's various parts, and it might be in the middle part of the supply chain where it gets shipped or processed. But there's a lot of parts of the ag and food supply chain where waste, you know, contributes to inefficiency and high costs. But I think what the consumer sees is just one part of it. From Cargill's standpoint, we're focusing where we're going to have a bigger impact, which is on the front end, where and when it's being produced.
I couldn't help noticing that Elon Musk had a bit of money to spend on solving the problem of global hunger. I think it was $6 billion. Is he $6 billion? So, Aloysius, how should he spend his $6 billion?
Yeah.
What was your plan for him? I'm sure you sent it to him. You tweeted him. What the plan was?
Well, you know, I wish I tweeted him.
I'm sure he'd tweet back, by all accounts.
Yeah, like if I guess $6 billion. I would invest in infrastructure, right? Like, because fundamentally, like, I would invest in moving farmers, small-scale farmers, from takers to a place where they have more options and choices. You and I, we can go on Amazon, Google, and order whatever we want. Farmers are often takers of services. They have one guy in the village that sells fertilizer, and that's it. There will be some aid project that comes and does good work. That will last for 3-4 years, and then they'll go away. Right, like what has to happen is that they need to have more options and choices where people compete on quality and price. So I'll build infrastructure that will give them more services on the farm, and that will give them more services in life too, because farmers are humans and they in order to for them to keep growing food, to take care of us, they need to be healthy, they need to be well in life. So that's what I'll invest money on. And if you build infrastructure, if they have good roads, they have good storage facilities, they would be able to reduce post-harvest loss, right? They will maintain quality of food. When they maintain quality of the food, they get paid more, right? So, and if they want fertilizer, like today, last year by this time, the price of NPK was $200 per ton. Today is $1,000, right? If they have the infrastructure.
So that's the fertilizer that's gone up fivefold last year.
Exactly, right? And they did nothing to contribute to that. If they have the, if there is infrastructure, the people would be able to easily reach them and they'll compete on quality and price. So that's what I'll use the money for if given the chance.
Mm. David, I have to ask you also, where do you think is the market failure that $6 billion would help solve?
I would go back to what I was saying about farmer education, training, regenerative ag, the points that Werner just made, soil health to increase yields, but also increase livelihoods in places like Africa. And then I would also say infrastructure. So, oh yeah, the U.S. just passed a bill on that, but does it get to places like ports and riverways, South America as well? So you've got this massive crop-growing region of the world, South America, which doesn't yet have the appropriate infrastructure to get it out of the fields and to the consumer. It doesn't do any good if you increase yields and increase farmer training and education if you can't get it to where it's needed. And so, but that's also true, you know, there's aging infrastructure in the U.S. What does it take? You know, was the disruption in the Gulf from that hurricane avoidable because of better infrastructure? Maybe. Maybe, or infrastructure that's going to be able to stand up better to the natural disasters which are inevitably coming with increasing frequency due to climate volatility. And then I would say whatever's left over to give it to Sarah and Aloysius' company to help farmers and to build the data.
Sarah, I suspect a lot of the different pieces have been said, but where do you think would be a really kind of catalyzing investment that Elon could make?
Well, I was going to say, it's going to take a lot more than $6 billion. And I don't think we want to trivialize the amount of investment it's going to take when we talk about infrastructure, right? It's infrastructure in terms of storage of grain for farmers, right? And when you are looking at small-scale farming, scale doesn't exist, and so therefore the cost of infrastructure is artificially too high. So how do you actually create aggregation methodologies that help us develop scale in communities and in parts of the world where that scale doesn't exist, right? I mean, these are really expensive, like, undertakings. And so my answer to this $6 billion is I would actually use that to create a financial institution that would help create the mechanisms to start financing all the changes that then need to be made, right? And I think one of the things to think about when thinking about sort of the financial markets as it relates to agriculture that I had not fully appreciated when I sort of left to start Grow is only a handful of agricultural products are even traded on a formal exchange. Most agricultural trades happen day to day, week to week. That's it. That's the way most of the market works. And we have to change that because I think, and you change that through capital. And I think creating new forms of financial institutions that truly innovate new models of financing agriculture is a place that I think one could put a lot of good use. You know, the $6 billion could actually realistically create that sort of next level infrastructure that I think is necessary.
You're all in different ways at the heart of this challenge. Do you sometimes wonder, you think this is actually the time we're gonna fail, even with all of our expertise? Do you have moments of doubt?
No, I would rely on the ingenuity of our people and the power of science. I said it earlier, yeah, that level of comfort is currently as high as it's never been. Yeah, we just have to find the right solutions with science and technology to solve the problems of society and the planet. Yeah, and I have absolutely no doubt that we are going to succeed.
Well, if there was ever a 12 months that showed us the rightness of being confident in science and the miraculous nature of science, but also the humility we need in face of some of these rising challenges, it's the last 12 months. But thank you to all of you, and thanks for listening. That's it from this special edition of Stephanomics. We'll be back next week with a bit more from Singapore and from other parts of the world. This episode was produced by Magnus Hendrickson, as ever, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy.